It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, our favorite food scientist is back. Shirley Currier is author of Cookwise and a woman who not only makes food science logical, she makes it fun. And with a little of Shirley's science, you can keep a head of lettuce in top shape for 6 weeks. Our road food mavens, Jane and Michael Stern, discovered the king of steak sandwiches in Chicago. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins talks great melters. We hear what makes a dish sing from a legendary chef. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner shops the web. And we have open lines for your calls. All this coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I'd like to talk about fennel, both the vegetable and the seed. I think they're overlooked by a lot of people because they don't know how to use them. So here's a few ideas. First, let's figure out how to identify fennel. Now, the vegetable is sometimes labeled anise, probably because it has a subtle sweet taste of anise. What's interesting here is that a lot of people who don't like the flavor of anise like fennel. Well, there's something about it. I don't know what it is, but it makes it very appealing. Now, if you've never seen the vegetable fennel, it has stalks that look a lot like bright green celery and leaves that are lacy and delicate, like dill. The base of the stalks, though, plump up into these white bulbs that are about the size of a fist. Now, that's what you eat, and you can eat it raw, roasted, steamed, braised, almost any way that you'd like to cook it. Now, fennel seed comes from another member of the fennel family. It's called Florence fennel. It tastes sweet with hints of orange, black pepper, and, of course, anise. Now, usually you crush it or grind it to release its flavor. I love to cook crushed fennel seed with poached fruits. I put it in some pound cakes, and it's delicious with any seafood, with pork, and fennel seed, like fennel the vegetable, gets on with most green herbs. It loves garlic, tomato. It really is delicious with intensely flavored olives, hot peppers, and lemon and orange were made for fennel. Now, when Mediterranean recipes call for wild fennel, which folks who live in California might find growing on the roadside, but for the rest of us, we'll be up a creek. Anyway, when you want wild fennel, you can simulate its snappy character by mixing crushed fennel seed, orange zest, and black pepper, which, by the way, is a great rub for grilled or roasted pork or lamb. So you've already got one recipe. Okay, now let's talk about how to enjoy sweet fennel, which is what the vegetable is called. I always trim away the stalks because they're usually too fibrous to eat, but I freeze them for later use because I put them in fish stocks or I flavor stews with them. In the south of France, people take dried stalks of wild fennel and they throw them onto the fire when they grill fish, so it scents the flesh of the fish toward the end of cooking. Since fennel flourishes in the Mediterranean, most fennel dishes have Mediterranean flavors. Let's begin by talking about raw fennel. This is great to nibble on its own or with cheese or just put it in a green salad. Now, here's one of the easiest salads. It's done with fennel and orange. It's colorful and it's a classic. Just cut the fennel bulb into thin strips and arrange it on a big platter with rounds of peeled and sliced fresh orange. Add red onion rings, scatter some black olives on it, sprinkle it with a little olive oil, salt, and black pepper. Now, what I like about this salad is not only the taste. It's also that nothing can kill this salad. It doesn't wilt, and it gets better with sitting. Now, you can braise fresh fennel beautifully. Serve it on its own for supper or with grilled foods. Fennel gets along with garlic and tomatoes beautifully. So here's how you'd cook braised fennel. Film the bottom of a big shallow pan with olive oil. Brown together some coarse chopped onion and thick sliced fennel. Season it with crushed fennel seed, hot pepper, lots of garlic, and some white wine. Add tomatoes and cook until the fennel's tender. Then you can serve it hot or at room temperature. Now, for the most delicate and elegant fennel, steam it, dab butter on it, put Parmigiano on it, and run it into the oven. So the next time you see fresh fennel or fennel seed in the market, try it and tune in for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we meet up with our favorite food scientist, Shirley Currier. Shirley is the author of the best-selling book, Cookwise. She's going to talk about green things today. Pretty appropriate for the season. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins has the last word on the great melters of the cheese world. Now, he's not talking Velveeta here, folks. And then we meet up with legendary chef Andre Sultner, cruise the web with kitchen designer Deb Krasner, and as usual, open up the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. Now, that number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with that dining duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, what have you been up to?
Well, Lynn, you know, in our long friendship with you, need I tell you that my husband is a native Chicagoan, and he thinks he knows everything in the world about that Chicago specialty, Italian beef. Well, on our last trip to Chicago, we actually found not only a new Italian beef eatery, but probably one of the best we've ever had.
This shows you that nobody in the world knows everything. But well, Michael, you learned something new about Chicago? I can't believe this.
It also shows you how even the word new is kind of relative, because the new eatery that we found on the south side of Chicago opened in 1946. So it's only relatively new in the history of Italian beef sandwiches. But I'll tell you, the specialty of this place, which is called Rico Bene's, and has been there since 1946, is not only Italian beef sandwiches, which we've already talked to you about at great length, but also something that is unique to the south side of Chicago and never really sort of spread throughout Chicagoland as Italian beef did, and that is the Italian breaded steak sandwich.
Breaded steak?
I suspect, Lynn, you know about this. This seems to me to probably have antecedents in real Italian cooking. It is a pounded thin steak, pounded so hard and so thin that it's wider than a plate, that is lightly breaded and then fried, then rolled up with a coat of what they call gravy, but you and I would call tomato sauce, and put inside a really wonderful loaf of Italian bread.
I have to confess, the first step of that, I've seen my cousin in Tuscany do, but they never had the intelligence to do what sounds like the consummate step, which is the rolling and the sauce and the bread. This sounds great.
What do they call it in Tuscany?
I don't know, manza battuto, or, you know, beaten beef.
It's just like a pounded cutlet, or a
scallope di manzo, or whatever. Manzo means beef in Italian. But this sounds great. So it's got sauce. And then
it's got sauce kind of rolled into it. It's rolled almost like a pinwheel, and it's huge. I mean, the amount of beef is absolutely phenomenal. And, of course, you know, the traditional breaded steak eaters get fried hot peppers, maybe some spicy giardiniera vegetable medley on top of it, maybe even some shredded mozzarella. It's really two meals in one sandwich.
This thing sounds like you can't get your teeth into it.
No. It's so big.
And it comes with really probably the greatest side dish for fried meat that already has mozzarella and bread on it, which is French fries with melted cheddar cheese on it to round out the meal nutritionally.
This is the cardiologist's dream.
What does the place look like? What does it feel like?
It's really beautiful, don't you think, Michael?
It is. You know, it used to be, when it opened in 1946, it was in the Maxwell Street area of Chicago, and it was kind of a funky sandwich stand. They recently kind of redid it. It's a very modern, clean, kind of sanitary lunchroom, but its walls are decorated with really spectacularly interesting photographs of old Chicago life, old South Side Chicago life in particular.
But it does have a 1940s feel to it. I mean, it does have that kind of, you know, sort of tile roadhouse feel to it. And as Michael was saying, I mean, the photos on the walls of the Italian-American population of Chicago in the 1940s, I mean, it really is like, it's almost like going back to Ellis Island in New York. I mean, you really get a sense of the immigrant history of this region.
There are weddings, there are funerals, there's street life, there are people sitting around on door stoops, and lots of pictures of people eating steak sandwiches.
But not with, I think the French fries with molten cheese
must have come about
in the last 10 years, because I did not see any French fry eaters in these old pictures.
Okay, I'm off to Rico Bene in South Chicago. Bene. Hey, thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it, bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down.
Shane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. They're here every week with new road food finds, and every week you can get a list of their discoveries on our website at splendidtable.org. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins stops by the show often. Steve is the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer, and is a man who spent nearly 25 years traveling the world learning about cheese. Steve, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, I recently had a great grilled cheese sandwich, and I want to know what makes a great melting cheese.
Oh, this sounds like one of the Stern segments.
Yeah, kind of. Hey, but what is it? Because you're the cheese guy. You know this stuff.
You know, grilled cheese sandwiches are definitively made with American cheese and some butter. We're perfectly fine, but come on, we're not kids anymore. We're adults. We don't eat American cheese unless somebody's twisting our arm. Best thing to use for a grilled cheese sandwich is one of the mountain cheeses that come from the Alps, be it a Swiss or a French or an Italian cheese. And with that, you have a much more ebullient flavor that billows out of the cheese rather than something that's made by a machine, i.e. American cheese.
Uh-huh. Is it that mountain cheeses really do melt better than other cheeses?
Yes, they absolutely melt better. They are as a result of a recipe that we refer to as cooked curd, whereby the casein bands together, and when it's then shredded coarsely and heat is applied, it melts into a real sort of fondant, like we consider chocolate. Other cheeses are just not suitable for melting because they clump up or they become rubbery the way the sheep's cheeses from Greece are, and they're not made to be melted the way the mountain cheeses are from the Alps.
Can you name some good melters for me?
The best melters I will name for you.
Only the best.
When you make a fondue, everybody knows that you use Emmental, which is the Swiss or French cheese that has big holes in it.
Right.
That's Swiss or French Emmental. But Emmental is made from part skim milk, which means it doesn't have the body to give the creamy, terrific, just undulating melt that the Gruyères will give you. Gruyères are not made from part skim milk. They're made from whole milk. And the Gruyères that come from Switzerland and France, the one in France is called Comté, are the ultimate melters. Absolutely the ultimate. And I would quickly follow that with the fact that the Italian Fontina is perhaps the greatest melter of all. Italian Fontina is slightly a softer cheese than either the French Comté or the French Gruyère. And it has much fuller flavor than either of those, and a much more rustic, earthy goût de terroir flavor that is immediately perceptible when it's melted. Oh, and Lynn, you know what's so interesting about Fontina is that it's not used in fondues the way fondues are so prevalent in Switzerland and in France. Fontina is instead turned into fonduta, a wonderful word, sort of a past tense verb,
yeah,
meaning sort of the same thing as fondue, but with a fonduta from Aosta, the way up in the northwest corner of Italy. It is the Fontina is coarsely shredded and then combined with eggs and butter. So it's a very, very rich sort of cheese porridge that you pour onto your plate over either toast that's been grilled and rubbed with olive oil or over some vegetables of some kind. It could be potatoes, it could be cardoons, those fabulous edible thistles that you never see in the Midwest. But Fontina is just the sublime melter.
What about gratins, cheeses for, you know, gratins, where you lay your vegetables and cheese mm-hmm. and you bake it? What do you suggest
there? My mouth is watering as you say that. Well, the classic one is the patate dauphinoise, scallop potatoes. But it feels so good to say dauphinoise.
Yes, it does. It does. How is it done, and which cheese would you use for it?
I would use, if I had a better choice than Comté or Emmental, I would use the Savoie Beaufort, B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T, like Beaufort, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Beaufort is the prince of Gruyères, it's referred to. It costs about twice as much as anything else, but it is an absolute joy because it's only made from the milk of the Alpage. The Alpage is the late August, September milk that comes out of this region, Savoie and Franche-Comté, at the very end of summer, beginning of autumn, when the fields are their lushest and most profuse with a variety of vegetation. The milk is very much affected by this lushness, and that I recommend very, very highly, as well as the other Savoie mountain cheese that's called Abondance. And when you make scallop potatoes, all you're doing is a great opportunity to get the mandolin out and make thin slices of some good starchy potato that you then boil a very short time and layer into a baking pan with cream, and you've rubbed a little bit of nutmeg around, you've rubbed it with garlic, and you're layering in the potatoes and you're pouring the more cream over it, and then you add the shredded Beaufort or Comté or Abondance, whatever your choice might be, and you bake it in the oven, and oy, what a flavor. I mean, billowing flavor and aroma of this extraordinary mountain cheese that's still made by hand the old way, has been for centuries, always made from raw cow's milk. And I think that's something that you and I must stress, is that the really great melting cheeses are 99% cow's milk.
Steve, thank you.
Pleasure.
I'll stop the world and melt with you. You've seen the difference and it's getting better all the time. There's nothing you and I won't do. Let's stop the world. I'll stop the world and melt with you.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve behind the counter at Fairway Markets in New York City. You can find Steve's cheese picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, outrageous food scientist Shirley Currier, legendary chef Andre Sultner, and your calls. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show devoted to life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Scientist Shirley Currier is a culinary sleuth who troubleshoots for the food industry and for home cooks. Most of us who work in the business have sent up a flare for Shirley's help at one time or another. And when Shirley offers a seminar for food pros, it's standing room only. Shirley, welcome.
Thrilled to be here.
Shirley, I want to talk about vegetables, how to store them and how to cook them. Because I get some stuff home, like the salad, you know, from the supermarket. Mm-hmm. I put it in the fridge, and it's not good news 2 or 3 days later. You know, it's starting to get brown and ugly. So what can I do?
That's it, the dreaded brown slime. The thing to do, now what you have to realize is that fruits and vegetables are plant parts. And they're alive and breathing. Just because you pulled them off the plant doesn't mean their little cells are dead. Their little cells are taking in oxygen just like we do and using it to burn up big things and giving off carbon dioxide just like we do. So what you have to do, you've got actually three problems. The first one is my buddy Harold McGee. He always says fruits and vegetables are nothing but wrappers for water. So the first thing you have to do.
I love the way you scientists break things down, you know, to simplest kind of part. Okay.
So we've got these wrappers for water. So you have to be sure that they're full of water. You know, they're nice and plump.
So you mean if you soak them, they get full of water.
You soak them. Okay. Exactly, exactly. And this is like 30 minutes in ice water. But the second part is that any surface water, mold and bacteria and all these dreaded things grow on surface water. So you've got to get the lettuce as dry as you can. Fill up its cells, but then get the surface, get rid of all the little drops on the surface.
Uh-huh.
Because these mean the dreaded brown slime 4 days later, you can be sure. Now, different people have different ways of trying to get rid of this surface water. I have an old Pella case, and I put my lettuce in and step out the back door and go, shoo, sling it around my head. And the neighbors already know we're crazy, so it doesn't bother them. Other people like to use just a salad spinner mm-hmm. so that they can get the excess water off. Then the third thing that you've got to do, now that you've got the cells full of water and the surface as dry as possible, is to cut off its oxygen. Ah, you have to be cruel. See, if your lettuce is going... that means it's deteriorating fast. If you get rid of the surface water and then put it in a freezer type, zip top type bag mm-hmm. and squeeze all the air out. You want this heavy freezer bag because most plastic bags are permeable. So, you know, your lettuce can still get all the oxygen it wants. And
uh-huh.
still go- So, and if I want the lettuce to last, and I mean really last, I used lettuce that I had in the fridge for 6 weeks. I used it for a photo shoot.
Used it for a photo shoot, which means it had to look wonderful.
It had to look good. That's right. The big secret is to cut off the oxygen. I will wrap it in a dry paper towel
right.
and then roll it up in this freezer type heavy zip top bag and squeeze the air out and seal it. And refrigerated, this lettuce will really, really keep well.
This is great. What about other vegetables, green beans and whatever, broccoli? Do I wash that and do the same thing?
Yes, except for fragile things like strawberries, raspberries, mushrooms. See, mushrooms are like sponges, and what you want them to do is soak in the sauce you're going to put them in, and not fill up on water. So the things like that, and, fresh herbs like basil, you can't really wash them until you're ready to use them. But most of your fruits and vegetables, their shelf life's enhanced by cutting off their oxygen supply and by chilling. You want to be sure to refrigerate everything.
So no moisture, no air, and keep it cold.
Right. And this is why those drawers in refrigerators, They cut down on air circulation, and so they're very helpful in giving you longer shelf life with some fruits and vegetables.
Let's talk about cooking. So every once in a while, you'll boil up the green beans, and they turn a yucky color.
The yucky army drab.
Yeah.
It's acid, and this is acid out of the vegetables themselves. When you heat the vegetables, their cells cook and their little walls shrink and they start leaking like crazy. And you have about 7 minutes cooking time with most green vegetables before you get a ton of acid coming out of them that's going to discolor them. Then the other problem is after they're cooked, you have to be careful about acid in any dressing or topping on them. Chlorophyll, which is the bright green in cooked green vegetables,
right.
It has two forms. It has its beautiful bright green form, and it has its yucky army drab form. and what happens if anything acidic, I mean, even a mildly acidic ingredient, gets to cooked green vegetables, chlorophyll has a ring structure and has magnesium in this little ring. And ploop, its magnesium falls out of the ring if you get near it with acid. So you have to start thinking, no acid, no matter what. And now what this means, you have to get creative. Suppose you say, but I love lemon asparagus. What can I do? No lemon juice, yucky army drab in 10 minutes, but lemon zest, the grated peel of the lemon, that will give you magnificent, fresh, bursting lemon flavor without the acid. So you have wonderful lemon asparagus just using a little oil and salt and maybe a tiny pinch of sugar and some lemon zest. Now, with other vegetables, suppose you want to do a marinated green bean salad.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is make a vinaigrette without vinegar. Who needs vinegar in a vinaigrette?
But then you have something called oil as opposed to a vinaigrette.
It's easy, Lynn. Just substitute 2 tablespoons of water, no matter how much vinegar's in the recipe.
If
it were a third of a cup, just throw in 2 tablespoons of water. And go with the rest of your ingredients. I usually put a little bit of onion or a shallot in my vinaigrette.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to do a basil vinaigrette that I throw in some fresh basil leaves and grind them at the last. And if you've got something like that, you'll never miss the vinegar. Now, you do want to add the water. And the reason is, remember, some things, flavor compounds, dissolve in fats. And so the oil would dissolve those and bring them into the dish. And other things dissolve in water. So you want to be sure you've got that 2 tablespoons of water to pull out water-soluble flavors and have them out there in the dish, you know, for the most flavor.
What a great piece of information. Shirley, thank you.
You are so welcome.
Oh,
Shirley Currier is author of Cookwise and contributing editor to Fine Cooking Magazine. You can get Shirley's salad recipe for mixed greens with walnuts two ways. Simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101, or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Have you ever wondered what it is that takes a dish from good to fantastic? Is there a magical something? Well, reporter Scott Haas has met with a man who should know, the legendary chef Andre Sultner.
This is Scott Haas, and I'm at Sandrine's Restaurant in Harvard Square with the godfather of French cooking, Andre Sultner, who 35 years ago set the benchmark for fine French dining when he opened Lutèce on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I'm here to try and find out, what is it that makes a dish terrific? I mean, I know when I bite into something, whether it's good or bad, but I want to know a little bit more about what are the essential ingredients? What do you need to make a dish perfect? Andre, it's a pleasure to be able to enjoy this experience with you.
It's great to be with you. I'm happy to be in Boston with you all, and we will taste our food.
In your cookbook, the Lutèce cookbook, there's hundreds of different recipes. When you went about creating those recipes, what were some were there core thoughts you had about creating these recipes?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I hate to say creating, you know. My recipes in my cookbook are not creations. And to my chefs, I always say, hey, guys, don't try too much to create. Do what the proper way, the nice way, the way we should do. And in my book, I don't try too much to create.
The chef and owner of Sandrine's has just arrived. This is Raymond Ost. Pleased to meet you again.
Nice to see you again. Good afternoon.
What exactly are you cooking up this afternoon?
I'm going to do an Alsatian Flammekuch for you so you can taste a little bit home, Alsace, where it is from us. And then after that, you're going to have the special that we serve tonight, the pheasant Wellington.
Lovely. This is not my typical Wednesday lunch, by the way. This is quite a treat. Well, the first of the food has arrived. It's Raymond, how do you pronounce this?
Flammekuch.
And I'm not going to take the chance of describing this in front of two great French chefs, so which one of you gentlemen would like to describe this?
Well, Raymond, you did it, so you describe it.
Okay, that's a very traditional dish in Alsace, and it's very old tradition, by the way. It's a bread dough, and it's covered with fromage blanc, and then after that, you cover it with caramelized onions and smoked bacon.
Well, let's try some. And of course, it's delicious. The cheese is mild enough so that the bacon can come out. The bread is not soft. Is that why it works?
The original recipe in Alsace, this is what I learned. This is how it comes since 100 years. I mean, I am not changing anything or even more.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens.
Well, next dish. This is the menu of André Sultner for tonight, and you're having a taste. It's a pheasant breast wrapped with Savoy cabbage and then wrapped around with puff dough. And the sauce is a truffle sauce, a sauce périgourdine.
How did this dish come about?
Well, that's pretty traditional again, you know, because we should not play with food, you know. We should try to cook it the way it was experienced the last 50 years or 100 years and should do it the right way, you know.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is, if all the dishes are traditional, where do you fit in? Where do you fit in as the... Are you simply the mailman? I mean, are you just delivering this? But there's some aspect of your personality in these dishes.
Maybe I should tell you love comes in, you know. if you cook and you cook for somebody and you put love in, that you can feel it. Why the customer doesn't know exactly why it tastes like that?
So the answer is it's not a question only of ingredients. The answer is you have to put your soul into the cooking.
Absolutely. At first, you have to have the right ingredients. If you have the wrong ingredients, you can put as much soul you want. It will never come out good. Then you have to put technique to be able to serve it hot, for example, because the best meal, which is cooked very well, good ingredients with love and so, which is not hot, it's no good neither. But besides that, you have to put this soul in, you know, and that's then a different story for each chef, you know. A chef who is a very good technician doesn't mean that his food tastes so good. Almost every kid likes mother's cooking, you know. Why? It's not because all mothers are great chefs. In contrary, many, many mothers are not so great chefs. But they cook for their child with love. They want to please their child. And that's why we say mother's cooking. And I give you a secret. When I dated my wife, I cooked for her. That's why we get married, I think.
Elle avait sous sa toque de martre, sur la butte Montmartre, un petit air innocent. On l'appelait Rose, elle était belle, à sentait bon la fleur nouvelle, rue Saint-Vincent.
We've reached the sad but inevitable point where the meal is over, and I want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking the time to educate me about what goes into these wonderful recipes.
Well, it was nice to be with you, and we thank you that you appreciate our cooking.
Yeah. As a critic, how would you rate us? Pretty good.
This is 4 stars. This is heaven. This is heaven.
Well, we like you too, then.
On l'appelait Rose, elle était belle, elle sentait bon la fleur nouvelle, rue Saint-Vincent.
Scott Haas covers food and wine for WBUR in Boston and writes for Gourmet Magazine. The piece was produced by John Marston. Well, it's trivia time. Time for today's trivia challenge. The question is, which popular soft drink originally contained lithium? Again, the question is, which popular soft drink originally contained lithium? Those were the days, guys. Well, we're going to be back with that answer. And with kitchen designer Deborah Krasner, who's been cruising the web, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, which popular soft drink originally contained lithium? The answer is 7-Up. When C.L. Griggs first invented the soda back in 1929, he called it Bib Label Lithiated Lemon Lime Soda. Definitely a catchy title. His first advertising slogan for his soda was, "It takes the ouch out of grouch." This wasn't idle boasting. The lithiated in the title stood for one of the original ingredients, lithium, the drug used today to treat manic depressives. Now, you have to remember that sodas were usually created in drugstores because originally they were considered medicines. People drank soda for all sorts of ailments, especially as tonics, something to lift up lagging energy or depression. So tossing a little lithium into the mix probably didn't seem a problem. Eventually, the soda lost its lithium, and probably its kick, got a new name and bouncing bubbles in its ads. Now, there's the Vietnamese connection. I was at a Vietnamese restaurant that had gotten high marks in a recent review. Their sweet sour dipping sauce was head and shoulders over any other I'd tasted. When I asked the owner what his secret was, he proudly explained he used 7-Up. "You have wonderful products here in America," he said. That's Aretha Franklin, and I don't think I will ever get tired of hearing that woman. Well, the phone lines are open. Give us a call. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's talk. I'll take a shot at anything you want to talk about. Let's get right to it. Joe's calling. Hi, Joe. What do you want to talk about?
I have a basic question about when I'm cooking something, when I should cover it.
When you should cover it. Okay.
Yeah. Even when I'm sautéing something, I like to cover it because of the protect the room from the smoke and the grease, you know? But then I see a difference.
What's the difference that you see? Because you may be able to answer your own question here.
Well, it seems like I'm not sautéing when I cover something that I'm trying to sauté it. It seems that it becomes more of a steamed or a stewed.
Yep, that's exactly right. Well, see, now, so you want to know why would you cover something or not cover it? Is that
my
the deal?
My real dilemma is when I cook pasta.
Yeah.
The packages seem to say cook it when it returns to boiling, to cook it uncovered. And I always wondered why, because I have a problem and it's easier for me to cook it covered.
This is the thing with pasta. The whole key with pasta is you want to boil it as fast as you can. And I'm like you. I usually keep it partially covered because it just helps it boil faster. And there's also less chance of the water boiling away. But when it comes to things like, for instance, sautéing a piece of meat, when you're cooking things that are very tender.
Right.
Let's say you're making a steak, you know, in a skillet on top of the stove, for argument's sake. Generally, very tender things that you're cooking and you're sautéing or you're browning them in a pan, you don't cover them because they do tend to develop that more of that stew-like taste. And you're holding in moisture when you cover. And you don't want to do that with something like a steak or perhaps even a chicken breast. With a pork chop, which takes a little longer to cook, some people like to do that because it creates a little bit of a pan sauce also. If you're doing sautéed chicken, now a classic sautéed chicken is you take a big, wide, shallow pan, put a little fat in it, and you brown the chicken on both sides. And then technically a sauté means to cook something in its own juices or with very, very little moisture.
Right.
Well, in that case, because you know how you want to cook a chicken all the way through, you don't want to have it rare like a steak or medium rare. You want it well done. So there's where I would cover it. Let it cook only in its own juices. Maybe a little bit of wine or a little bit of something else, but no more than a quarter or a half cup of liquid. And I'd keep the heat moderate and cook it maybe 25, 30 minutes. But in that case, I'm cooking it until it's well done. But when I'm cooking something that by its nature is already very tender, then I generally want to cook it uncovered.
I see.
You know, you've asked a really complicated question, and there's a lot of shadings to why you cover and you don't cover.
Right. See, my real problem is my new stove.
Oh, and it's a mess, isn't it?
No, well, no, that's not the problem. It's a center downdraft stove, which I don't recommend to anyone.
You mean you want it? You have a brand new stove, and now you want to trade it in?
Yes, because when I turn on the fan,
yeah,
center downdraft. Like, let's say I'm cooking pasta,
right?
And I'm sauteing something at the same time.
Yeah.
When I turn on the exhaust, the pasta will stop boiling because all the heat is sucked right down.
You're kidding.
No.
You mean the heat from the burner?
Yes, in a center downdraft stove, yes.
What a lousy design.
I know that. I don't think they ever realized it.
Is it a gas stove?
Yes.
All right, maybe there's one way around this, because one of the reasons you would turn on the fan is that you have stuff, grease popping out of your saute pan. Try a splatter screen. These are big, round screens with handles. It looks like a screen door, but it's round.
That's a good idea, right.
And it does help protect your stovetop, and you don't have to use that downdraft. But you know the other thing, quite seriously?
Right.
This is why manufacturers adore this show. I would contact the manufacturer. Maybe you could get your stove replaced with another model that doesn't have a downdraft system.
Well, you see, the problem is I built a new house, and I put the stove in the center island. And the only way around that is to put an overhead hood,
right?
Which I didn't want to do.
What kind of stove is it?
You want me to mention that?
Yeah.
It's a Gen Air.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
I think they're all the same, actually.
You know what? This is a reliable company. I mean, it's a company that certainly has been around a long time. Call them and see if they can make you a happier customer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would do that. Hey, Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
And I wish you good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Goodbye. You know, one of the things that manufacturers should allow us to do, because think about what it costs to buy a stove, is we should be able to go into showrooms and there should be these models that we can cook on. And I do know that when you get into some very pricey ranges, there are some manufacturers or some dealers that actually have a setup that you can do that. But I would really seriously start requesting this. You know, offer to bring your own food. But I want to know how these things are going to behave. And you live with a stove for a long time. I mean, some people live longer with their stoves than they do with their mates. Kevin's on the line. Kevin, what's happening?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Back in August, I foolishly promised some friends of mine in upstate New York that I could find them calf's feet.
On the calf or?
Off the calf.
Off the calf. For what purpose?
Well, they want to make a Jewish dish called pachah.
What is pachah?
But pachah is essentially calf's foot jelly.
Isn't it kind of poached it's spices and water, and you poach the feet until they're very tender, and it makes this very clear liquid, and it gels naturally, and you serve it.
It gels naturally.
But now they want to make this dish.
So they would like to make this dish. So I promised that I could find calf's feet. Now, I can find duck feet. I can find chicken feet.
Yeah.
I can find pig's feet. And I can find cow's feet.
But you can't find calf's feet.
But I can't find calf's feet. And I've gone to a number of meat markets in the Twin Cities, and everybody says, oh, no problem. Let me talk to my supplier. Call me back in a couple days. I call back in a couple days, and they very sheepishly say, no, we can't get that.
Okay. Well, you live in Minnesota then.
Right.
I'm wondering if it may not make sense to call a couple of places in New York City.
Okay.
I'm just thinking, call places, areas where there are very large, vibrant Jewish or Eastern European populations, where there's really still a big demand for these traditional ingredients.
Okay.
Now, of course, only two names come to mind here, and I know there've got to be others. Neither one of them are known to be Jewish markets, but they may be helpful.
Okay.
One, whenever I think of a meat market, a great meat market in New York, I think of Lobel's.
Lobel?
Lobel's.
Oh, Lobel.
I think it's Lobel apostrophe S. It's something like okay. that. It should be able to get it in information. And another one, it's a German store, but it just might do the trick. They're famous for sausages and that kind of thing, but they may have calf's feet.
Okay.
Or no. But see, either one of these places could tell you where you could call that they could ship them to you.
Okay, that'd be great.
Schaller and Weber.
S-H-E-L-L.
No, S is in Sam. S-C-H, I think, A-L-E-R, and Weber with two B's, okay. I think. I try either one of those, and I'd explain what you're looking for, and they would probably say to you, oh, whoever told you to call us is nuts, but let us tell you who you should call.
Okay, great.
Because if, you know, places like that where there's still immigrants coming in and that kind of thing, you're probably pretty likely to find calf's feet.
Sure.
They used to be, do you know calf's foot jelly used to be what was given to invalids a long time ago?
I didn't know that.
It was, probably not with all the garlic, but it was considered to be very nutritious and easy to digest.
Well, and there are cookbooks that have, you know, numerous recipes that call for calf's feet. I just can't figure out why they're so hard to find.
Well, we know there are calves out there. We know
exactly.
They walk.
That's
so,
right.
Well, look, good luck.
Thank you very much. I'll try both these places.
Okay.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
This is the kind of thing that a lot of people get turned off to, the idea of cooking the foot of an animal and the idea of liquid being jellied. And, you know, then you eat this. But, guys, I can't tell you how good this is. These are the original sources of aspic and Jell-O. Except with Jell-O, all they did was they added a lot of sugar. And this really can be really good. Obviously, you really scrub the feet very, very well. But there's a lot of cartilage. Now, I know, we're going to get a lot of calls on this one, but this was what cooking was about years ago because people couldn't afford to throw anything away. And they ate all this stuff, and it was pretty nutritious, supposedly. Lots of protein, lots of good natural gelatin. Well, we're out of time for calls today, but we're going to be back next week. And remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner has a real-world approach to making our kitchens friendlier places. She joins us here on a regular basis. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So what have you been thinking about lately?
Well, I've just gotten a better computer with faster access, and so I've been surfing the internet trying to find out if people can really furnish their whole kitchens and think about kitchen design without ever taking off their nightgown or leaving their desks.
All right. I'm with you. Go ahead.
And indeed, you can. So I've just been finding the most incredible sites. In, you know, aside from all the obvious ones like going to a manufacturer and adding .com to the end, there are sites that really are very particular and that have equipment that you wouldn't believe you could buy over the internet. For instance, you can buy restaurant stoves over the internet, and you can sit at home at your desk comparing one brand of restaurant stove with another and get incredible prices. There are a number of places that have discounted restaurant supplies. One of them is called restaurant-supply.com, and it has a Wolf 18-inch two-burner all-stainless steel cooktop on a little stand for $818. It's incredible.
I mean, for a Wolf, that's for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just two burners. But still, if you have a very small kitchen and that's all the burners you want, or if you have an electric range and you just want two gas burners, it's a great buy.
Huh.
Similarly, something called American Restaurant Equipment, AmerestEquip.com, has a 48-inch, eight-burner DCS stove for $1,858.
This is a great buy.
It's an incredible buy, and it's a great resource. So that just got me going. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to imagine a dream kitchen for myself in terms of style. And I thought, what about really beautiful, evocative, old-world sinks? So I went into a search engine, and first I looked for stone sinks, and then I looked for copper sinks, and I found some wonderful things. There's a website called GalleriaCollection.com, which has the most beautiful copper sink I have ever seen. And it's under $1,500. It's just, it's got an apron so that it has, you know, you see the copper front of it as you come into the room. And it's hammered, and it's just beautiful and large. And it's just the kind of sink that any cook would love to own. Similarly, there's something called rmgstone.com, which has soapstone sinks with lots of pictures and examples, and they also custom make them to your specifications. So you can just sit at home and look at these incredible sinks and think, how would they work in my kitchen?
So this is really better than going to the proverbial local showroom, because you can see stuff that
most showrooms are never going to have all in one place.
Not only that, but you can travel the world. I was looking for tiles from Spain because I think Spanish tiles are very beautiful with a kind of Moorish decoration. And I found a food site called tienda.com. And in addition to selling food, they sell beautiful Spanish tiles at very reasonable prices and Delft tiles from Holland. Very hard to find in this country. Now, this site happens to be in the United States, but they do direct importing from Spain.
Now, you can actually order directly from all of these sites?
Yes.
Huh!
They are all set up for direct order. Then, the most incredible site I went to was a stonemasonry in Jaipur, India, which sells containers of stones. And they had the most beautifully colored granites and marbles and sandstones that I've ever seen anywhere in the world. And I didn't inquire too closely about ordering because I think that you probably have to order an entire container of slabs. However,
with which you can build a small monument, yes.
If you want to have your own Taj Mahal. But it does seem to me that if you fell in love with one of those stones and you had a local stone dealer, it might be possible to ask them if they would be interested in making an order from this place. And then you could at least get the stone.
I'll tell you, Deborah, you wheel and deal. I can picture you going up and down your block saying to folks, come on, get the granite counter. Come on, we'll go in on it together. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you.
Deb Krasner is author of Kitchens for Cooks and works out of her studio in Vermont. You can find her web discoveries on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, thanks for tuning in today. Be sure to join us next week and have a good one. And remember, you can get to us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Well, until we meet next time, let me leave you with an observation from Alex Levine. I quote, "Only Irish coffee provides in a single glass all four of the essential food groups: alcohol, caffeine, sugar, and fat." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.